Good afternoon. This is Matt Woodbury, and I'll be bringing you the first half of the Pantograph News today from the edition dated Friday, November 3rd, 2017. We'll get started with our first article entitled Family Keeps Court Vigil in Zimmerman's Death. Siblings Struggle with Loss, Prepare for Trial Against Ex-Husband. Written by Edith Brady Lunny. 3 years after Pam Zimmerman's death, friends and family members struggle with an unfillable void as they prepare for a trial against her former husband, accused of killing her over financial disagreements. She left a huge hole in the family, Pam Zimmerman's sister, Diane Gifford of Decatur, said on November 4, 2014, after her fiancé was unable to reach her. Police and friends found Pam Zimmerman, 53, behind the reception desk of her Eastside Bloomington office. She had been shot multiple times. 8 months later, Kirk Zimmerman, now 59, was charged with first-degree murder. The couple, whose three children were in high school, had divorced in 2012 after 20 years of marriage. Gifford remembers her sister as a dedicated mother who used her skills as an accountant to help care for the couple's three children. She always wanted to raise her kids and looked forward to being a grandma. "To miss out on being a grandma, that's huge," said Gifford. Pam Zimmerman's broad base of friendships and professional connections was evident after her death, said Gifford, as people from across the country expressed their condolences. Relatives and friends were aware of the animosity between the Zimmermans that had continued after their divorce. The two went back to court over unpaid child support payments Pam Zimmerman had submitted. Shortly before her death, she mailed an envelope to Kirk Zimmerman, demanding about $4,000 in child-related expenses and threatening a return to court if the debt was not paid. The dispute over money and the possibility of more court appearances is the basis of the state's theory as to why Kirk Zimmerman allegedly killed his ex-wife. Gifford was in St. Louis helping care for an aunt when she was called about her sister's death. "I could swear it took me 12 hours to get home," she recalled. Cousin Vicky Sartori of St. Louis also feels the loss. "We just sat and talked about our family, her kids. That's what I miss, our time together. I still wait for her to call me," Sartori said. Family members are determined to ensure justice is achieved in her sister's case. Wearing large buttons depicting a smiling image of their deceased sister, Gifford and her brothers Jim Smith of Decatur and Larry Alexander of Naperville attended every McLean County court proceeding. They share developments with their other sister, Eileen Million of Decatur. "We never thought we would be in this position," Gifford said of the family's involvement with the criminal justice system. Smith, as administrator of Pam Zimmerman's estate, pursued the almost $4,000 owed in child support at the time of his sister's death. Kirk Zimmerman paid the debt just ahead of a March 2015 hearing where indirect civil contempt charges were possible against him. Moving right along, our next story for today is entitled Pre-Trial Steps, Lengthy in Murder Case. Sorting Evidence for Jury Review Continues as Trial Slips into 2018. By Edith Brady Lunny. 3 years after Pam Zimmerman's death, a trial date has not been set for her accused killer. The work of sorting evidence to be presented to the jury continues as the potential trial date slips into 2018 against Kirk Zimmerman. He has been to court more than 30 times since his arrest in July 2015 on charges that he killed his former wife, Pam Zimmerman, on November 4, 2014. Confined to his home, wearing an ankle bracelet that ensures he leaves only for medical and lawyer-related appointments, Zimmerman, who has retired from State Farm, has put his Bloomington home on the market to raise money for his defense. The money is needed to hire experts to challenge evidence the state intends to introduce at trial, defense lawyer John Rogers said at previous court hearings. Zimmerman was ordered to home confinement as part of his release on $200,000 bond in November 2015. "A protracted calendar is not uncommon in a murder case," said McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers. "There have been a lot of motions, and those have to be resolved before we can go to trial. Obviously, everyone would like to see things move faster," said Chambers. Zimmerman is anxious for the case to move forward. "Mr. Zimmerman eagerly awaits his trial date," Rogers said. The case involves complex issues about the couple's finances and the reliability of gunshot residue evidence and automotive tracking devices. So far, the defense has filed 10 motions related to potential evidence that Zimmerman hopes will be limited or eliminated from the trial. The state has filed 3 motions, including one that took 4 days to resolve. The state also has appealed 2 rulings by Judge Scott Drazewski, one barring the use of a photo lineup, and the other severely limiting statements by witnesses who allegedly heard complaints from Pam Zimmerman about Kirk Zimmerman. Rogers has asked the Illinois Supreme Court to review an appellate ruling that reversed Drazewski's decision to seal 2 defense motions despite media objections. The lengthy pretrial process is necessary, said Rogers, noting the defense has been both successful and diligent in highlighting the evidence that needs to be excluded so as to set this matter for trial as soon as possible. Central Illinois has seen lengthy proceedings in other homicide cases. The 2009 murder cases against brothers Chris and Jason Harris in the deaths of the 5 members of the Rick G. family in Logan County concluded 3.5 years later with a life sentence for Chris Harris on murder charges and 10 years for Jason Harris on concealment of a homicide. The 4-week trial of Chris Harris was moved to Peoria County after a defense motion that cited extensive media coverage. No such motion has been filed in the Zimmerman case. Now we'll move on to a little bit of political news out of Washington. Our next article is entitled GOP Tax Bill Cuts Breaks Rates. Democrats say plan harms middle class. With fanfare and a White House kickoff, House Republicans unfurled a broad tax overhaul plan Thursday that would touch virtually all Americans and the economy's every corner, mingling sharply lower rates for corporations and reduced personal taxes for many with fewer deductions for home buyers and families with steep medical bills. The measure, which would be the most extensive rewrite of the nation's tax code in 3 decades, is the product of a party that faces increasing pressure to produce a marquee legislative victory of some sort before the next year's elections. GOP leaders touted the plan as a spark plug for the economy and a boon to the middle class and christened it the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. "We are working to give the American people a giant tax cut for Christmas," President Donald Trump said in the Oval Office. The measure, he said, will also be tax reform, and it will create jobs. It would also increase the national debt, a problem for some Republicans. And Democrats attacked the proposal as the GOP's latest bonanza for the rich, with a phase-out in the inheritance tax and repeal of the alternative minimum tax on the highest earners, certain to help Trump and members of his family and cabinet, among others. "If you're the wealthiest 1%, Republicans will give you the sun, the moon, and the stars, all of that at the expense of the great middle class," said House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. And there was enough discontent among Republicans and business groups to leave the legislation's fate uncertain in a journey through Congress that leaders hope will deposit a landmark bill on Trump's desk by year's end. Underscoring problems ahead, some Republicans from high-tax northeastern states expressed opposition to the measure's elimination of the deduction for state and local income taxes. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch of Utah called the House measure a great starting point, but said it would be somewhat miraculous if its corporate tax rate reduction to 20%, a major Trump goal, survived. His panel plans to produce its own tax package in the coming days. The House Republicans' plan, which took them months to craft in countless closed-door meetings, represents the first step in their effort to reverse what's been a politically disastrous year in Congress. Their drive to obliterate President Barack Obama's health care law crashed, and GOP lawmakers concede that if tax measure collapses, their congressional majorities are at risk in next November's elections. The package's tax reductions would outweigh its loophole closures by a massive $1.5 trillion over the coming decade. Many Republicans were willing to add that to the nation's soaring debt as a price for claiming a resounding tax victory, but it was likely to pose a problem for others, one of several brush fires leaders will need to extinguish to get the measure through Congress. Republicans must keep their planned shortfall from spilling over that $1.5 trillion line, or the measure will lose its protection against Democratic Senate filibuster, bill-killing delays that take 60 votes to overcome. there are just 52 GOP senators and unanimous Democrat opposition is likely. The bill would telescope today's 7 personal income tax brackets into just 4, 12%, 25%, 35%, and 39.6%. The 25% rate would start at $45,000 for individuals and $90,000 for married couples. The 35% rate would apply to family income exceeding $260,000 and individual income over $200,000, which means many upper-income families, whose top rate is currently 33%, would face higher taxes. The top rate threshold, now $418,400 for individuals and $470,700 for couples, would raise to $500,000 and $1 million. The standard deduction, used by people who don't itemize, around two-thirds of taxpayers, would nearly double to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for couples. That's expected to encourage even more people to use the standard deduction with a simplified tax form Republicans say will be postcard-sized. Many middle-income families would pay less, thanks to the bigger standard deduction and an increased child tax credit. Republicans said their plan would save $1,182 in taxes for a family of four earning $59,000. But features like phase-outs of some benefits suggest their taxes would grow in the future. The plan clearly chooses corporate CEOs and hedge fund managers over teachers and police officers, said Representative Bill Pascrell, a Democrat from New Jersey. One trade-off for the plan's reductions was its elimination of breaks that millions have long treasured. Gone would be the deductions for people's medical expenses, especially important for families facing nursing home bills or lacking insurance, and their ability to write off state and local income taxes. In other political news coming out of Washington, our next article is entitled, Manafort Says Mueller's Case is Embellished. President Donald Trump's former campaign chairman attacked an indictment accusing him of money laundering and other financial crimes, dismissing as embellished a criminal case brought by special counsel Robert Mueller and his team of investigators. Attorneys for Paul Manafort defended him in a court filing Thursday as a successful international political consultant who, by nature of his work on behalf of foreign political parties, was necessarily involved in international financial transactions. They argued that Manafort, who led Trump's campaign for several months last year, had done nothing wrong and did not pose a risk of fleeing the country. The filing was the first volley from Manafort's defense team, seeking to undermine a 12-count indictment charging him and longtime business associate Rick Gates in connection with their political consulting work for Ukraine's former ruling party. The charges were first announced by Mueller, a former FBI director appointed as special counsel in May to run the Justice Department's investigation into potential coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign. They were placed on house arrest earlier this week, released on multi-million dollar bonds meant to guarantee their appearances for future court dates. Both men appeared Thursday in federal court in Washington, where a judge determined that they would remain on home confinement and electronic monitoring, at least through the week's end. Attorneys for Manafort, 68, and Gates, 45, are asking U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson to lift the conditions of their home confinement and say the bonds are enough to ensure they show up for court. The judge said she would take up the matter again at a hearing on Monday, but in the meantime directed attorneys on both sides to not comment publicly on the case. Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing, had issued a statement to reporters outside the courthouse on Monday. I expect counsel to do their talking in the courtroom and their pleadings and not on the courthouse steps, Jackson said. Besides the indictment of Manafort and Gates, prosecutors revealed a guilty plea from a campaign advisor named George Papadopoulos, who admitted lying to the FBI about foreign contacts during the campaign. Prosecutors disclosed additional details about the wealth and international connections of Manafort and Gates in a court filing earlier this week that sought to keep them confined to their houses. Prosecutors note that Manafort has provided widely differing accounts of his assets in the past few years. In 2016 alone, he provided six different figures, ranging from $25 million to $136 million. Manafort also has three passports, and prosecutors say that in March, he registered a phone and email account using an alias. He then used that phone to travel to China, Mexico, and Ecuador, according to the filings, which do not say what alias he used. In a response Thursday, Downing countered that the passports are in his client's name and noted that, though it may be surprising to some, it is perfectly permissible to have more than one U.S. passport. He dismissed the allegation that Manafort was a flight risk, saying his client has traveled abroad and returned to the U.S., all while being well aware that he was under federal investigation and faced a possible criminal indictment. Downing also denied that Manafort was involved in any criminal activity related to his Ukrainian work. All funds that went through offshore bank accounts were from legal sources, he said. Manafort was not trying to conceal his assets, his attorney said, noting that funds originating in Ukraine and going through Cyprus ultimately arrived in the United States. Now let's switch gears, go back to some local news. Our next article is entitled, Senator's Accuser Seeks an Explanation. The political activist, who has accused an Illinois state Democratic leader of sexually harassing her, said Thursday that she wants to know why Senator Ira Silverstein faced no repercussions until after she went public this week. Denise Rothemer said Silverstein, who relinquished his leadership post and its $21,000 stipend Wednesday night, should resign the Senate seat representing Chicago that he's held since 1999. Rothemer, a victims' rights advocate from Ingleside, testified on Thursday before a House committee considering sexual harassment training for lawmakers, staff, and lobbyists. She described how the 57-year-old Silverstein sent her inappropriate social media messages, paid her unwanted compliments, and called her late at night last year while they were working on legislation. But she told the Associated Press Thursday that the issue has gone beyond Silverstein. She wants to know why her charge sat idle for nearly a year with no action, no communication, and Silverstein resigned only after she pointed a spotlight on him. What was so different in my complaint than in my testimony on Thursday that it led to the demotion? Rothmeyer asked. Was it because I had to go public? I made the complaint. Is it that the complaint doesn't mean anything as long as it doesn't go public? That's wrong. They only take action when light is shown on the issue. Silverstein, who Thursday denied harassing Rothemer, said he was working the bill when he communicated with her, didn't return a phone message Thursday. John Patterson, a spokesman for John Cullerton, dismissed any notion that the Senate president was reacting to negative publicity, implying Cullerton did not suggest the resignation and saying repeatedly, "We accepted Senator Silverstein's resignation from leadership." Rothemer became a reluctant public figure when stepped up to testify before the House Personnel and Pensions Committee on legislation authored by House Speaker Michael Madigan. It requires annual sexual harassment training for all members of the General Assembly, their staff members, and lobbyists. It would be monitored by the Legislative Inspector General. Rothemer said Silverstein took interest in a measure she was pushing to require free legal representation to crime victims moving through a complex criminal court system. Rothemer has made available more than 400 pages of printed Facebook conversations in which she points to inappropriate comments. She said Silverstein made late-night phone calls to her, called her intoxicating, and said, "I like having meetings with you because you're pretty to look at." Let's continue on with something a little bit more upbeat. The next article, entitled Red Cross Honors Local Heroes with Ceremony, written by Paul Schweich. Liz Larson brought a lot of energy wherever she went, said her husband, Nathan Stein. On July 29th, she used the last of her energy to save the life of Eleanor Hansen, 6, of Peoria Heights. On Thursday, Larson, 36, of Normal, was among several Central Illinoisans honored at the 13th Annual American Red Cross Serving Central Illinois Saluting Our Heroes Breakfast, attended by 540 people at the Doubletree by Hilton. Larson posthumously received the Good Samaritan Award. Liz brought a lot of fun wherever she went, longtime friend Sarah Hansen of Peoria Heights, Eleanor's mother, told the Pantograph. On July 29th, Larson joined Hansen and her three children on a float trip down a tributary of the Kankakee River near Wilmington. The two women were experienced in the water and checked the Illinois Department of Natural Resources website to find the safest river to float on that day. But they didn't know about a dam in the river, and there were no signs to warn them. When the group realized that they were about to go over a dam, Hansen and her two older children made it to shore, but the raft carrying Larson and Eleanor went over. Liz got Eleanor on a tree branch and kept her there, and she, Larson, held onto the branch, Hansen said. After rescuers arrived, Larson put a rope around Eleanor so she could be pulled out, but an exhausted Larson could no longer hold on and was swept under the water. "My daughter is here because she, Larson, sacrificed her life to save her," Hansen said. "I'm proud of her," Stein said. "It was right of her to prioritize keeping Eleanor safe, but it's devastating that it happened." Stein said, "So many people live their lives without recognition. It's gratifying that a large number of people heard her story." "I love her," Eleanor said. Also honored were Sergeant Joshua Rogers of Bloomington Armed Forces Award. Rogers, an Army Ranger who had three deployments to Afghanistan, died in action there on April 27th at age 22. Macon County Sheriff's Department Bart Hickley of Forsyth, Public Service Award. He risked electrocution when he pulled a woman from her burning vehicle as it rested on top of an electrical box. The woman's life was at stake, Hickley told the Pantograph. "There was no time to think about what I was doing." Bart is a fantastic example of what we hope every deputy would do if the opportunity presents itself, said Macon County Sheriff Howard Buffett. Maddie Beal, formerly of Bloomington, Health and Safety Award for performing CPR and using an AED to save the life of University High School basketball player Kai Bates Diop. Kenny Gray, 15, of Ottawa, Youth Award for saving an 11-year-old cousin by successfully performing abdominal thrusts after a bottle cap got lodged in his throat. Ruby's Rescue and Retreat of McLean Ambassador Award for helping to rescue more than 1,000 dogs in the past 12 years and finding new homes for dogs who survived Hurricane Harvey. Ryan Heron of Normal, Paula R. Walsh Volunteer Award for spearheading several projects for West Bloomington Revitalization Project's Tool Library. Greg Coos, Director Emeritus of McLean County Museum of History, the WJBC Don Munson Spirit of McLean County Award. With other area news, our next article is entitled Police Investigate Two Armed Robberies. Two men reported being robbed at knife point Wednesday in separated incidents Wednesday in Bloomington, and one victim suffered a wound to his hand. Bloomington police officers were dispatched at 11:05 p.m. to Advocate Roman Medical Center, Normal, for a man claiming to have been stabbed. The victim told police he was walking in the 800 block of West Monroe Street when he felt a sharp object strike his back and someone then demanded his wallet. The victim said he turned around and attempted to defend himself. He was stabbed in the hand before the robber fled west on foot, police said, adding the injury was not life-threatening. The suspect is described as a black male who is about 6 feet 4 inches tall, weighs about 180 pounds, and has a long, dark beard. At 8:42 p.m., police were called to the 1300 block of North Main Street. The victim in that case told police he was making a delivery on Ginger Trail earlier in the day when two male suspects displayed knives and demanded money from him. The suspects took an undisclosed amount of cash and fled south on foot. No injuries were reported in that incident. The suspects were described as black men, 18 to 22 years of age. Further details were not released. Investigations are ongoing. Anyone with information is asked to contact BPD detectives at 309-434-2379 or 309-434-2475. Another criminal news. This next article is titled Police, Two Found Dead in Decatur. Decatur, Illinois police say a 20-year-old man has been arrested in the deaths of two men found shot as a double homicide. Deputy Police Chief David Dickerson said in a statement the suspect faces preliminary charges of first-degree murder. The charges are subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. The Herald and Review Indicator reports officers responding to a call of shots fired found the two men dead in the front room of a mobile home at about 10:15 p.m. Tuesday. Deputy Chief David Dickerson said the investigation is very active and ongoing. A little bit brighter news, the next article is entitled U of I Makes Auditorium Safer. A report says safety corrections have been made at an University of Illinois Springfield auditorium after one concert patron was hurt and another died from a fall earlier this year. The safety report commissioned by the university says unspecified steps have been taken at Sangamon Auditorium to prevent a recurrence. It also says that a 2,000-seat performance venue needs to improve its hazard reporting process and training of employees on safety policies for the protection of workers and the public. We are pleased to have received the Sangamon Auditorium safety audit, and we are carefully reviewing the report to assess any needed improvements, university spokesman Derek Schnapp said. As we have noted before, the safety of our guests is a top priority, and the report confirms the auditorium is a safe facility. We're looking forward to another great season of outstanding performances. Gray and Associates of Champaign conducted the study for $5,000, the State Journal Register reported. Schnapp said damage settlements have also been finalized with the family of the man who died, John Kremitsky, 51, and the patron who was injured, Gregory Hoffman, 57. Kremitsky fell through an opening near the auditorium's main stage during a break in Pink Floyd tribute show in March. Hoffman was injured trying to help Kremitsky. Kremitsky died the following day at a nearby hospital. An autopsy concluded he died from blunt force injuries to his abdomen. He also suffered fractures to his ribs, spine, and pelvis, as well as a broken right leg. Hoffman broke both of his legs and jaw. He was released from the hospital 9 days after the incident. Let's wrap up the first half of the Pantograph today with something a little bit more fun. The last article for this segment is entitled Scientists, Hidden Chamber in Great Pyramid. Scientists say they have found a hidden chamber in Egypt's Great Pyramid of Giza in what would be the first such discovery in the structure since the 19th century, and one likely to spark a new surge of interest in the pharaohs. In an article published in the journal Nature on Thursday, an international team said the 30-yard void deep within the pyramid is situated above the structure's grand gallery and has a similar cross-section. The purpose of the space is unclear, and it's not yet known whether it was built with a function in mind or if it's merely a gap in the pyramid's architecture. Some experts say such empty spaces have been known for years. "This is a premiere," said Mehdi Tayobi, a co-founder of the Scan Pyramids Project and president of the Heritage Innovation Preservation Institute. "It could be composed of one or several structures. Maybe it could be another grand gallery. It could be a chamber. It could be a lot of things." The scientists made the discovery using cosmic ray imaging, recording the behavior of some atomic particles called muons that penetrate the rock similar to X-rays, only much deeper. Their paper was peer-reviewed before appearing in the Nature Science Journal, and its results were confirmed by other teams of scientists. "Chances of the space containing treasure or burial chambers are almost nil," said Aidan Dodson, an Egyptologist at the University of Bristol. "But the discovery helps shed light on building techniques." The pyramid's burial chamber and sarcophagus have already been discovered, so this new area was more likely kept empty above the Grand Gallery to reduce the weight of stone pressing down on its ceiling, he said. Egypt's former antiquities minister and famed archaeologist Zahi Hawass, who has been testing scanning methods and heads the government's oversight panel for the new techniques, said that the area in question has been known of for years and thus does not constitute a discovery. Well, that's going to wrap up the first half of Pantograph news for today. This is from the edition dated Friday, November 3rd, 2017. I'm Matt Woodbury. Thanks for listening. Stick around. We'll be back soon.